Chapter 36. The submersible sea slug looked aerodynamically clean and smooth from her outside. But to Pitt, as he contorted his 6'2" frame into the pilot's chair, the interior seemed a claustrophobic nightmare of hydraulic plumbing and electrical circuitry. The craft was 20 feet long and tubular in shape, with rounded ends like its lethargic namesake. It was painted bright yellow and had 4 large portholes set in pairs on its bow, while mounted along the top, like small radar domes, were 2 powerful high-intensity lights. Pitt completed the checklist and turned to Giordino, who sat in the seat to his right. "Shall we make a dive?" Giordino flashed a toothy smile. "Yes, let's." "How about it, Rudy?" Gunn looked up from his prone position behind the lower viewports and nodded. "Ready when you are." Pitt spoke into a microphone and watched the small television screen above the control panel as it showed the MODOK's Derek lift the sea slug from her deck cradle and gently swing her over the side and into the water. As soon as the diver had disconnected the lift cable, Pitt cracked the ballast valve, and the submersible began to sink slowly under the rolling, deep-troughed waves. "Life support timer on," Giordino announced. "An hour to the bottom, 10 hours for the search, 2 hours for surfacing, leaving us a reserve of 5 hours just in case." "We'll use the reserve time for the search," Pitt said. Giordino knew well the facts of the situation. If the unthinkable happened, an accident at 12,000 feet, there would be no hope of rescue. A quick death would be the only prayer against the appalling suffering of slow asphyxiation. He found himself actually amused at wishing he was back on board the Sappho-1, enjoying the uncramped comfort of open space and the security of her 8-week life support system. He sat back and watched the water darken as the sea slug buried her hull in the depths, his thoughts drifting to the enigmatic man who was piloting the craft. Giordino went back with Pitt to their high school days, when they had built and raced hot rods together down the lonely farm roads behind Newport Beach, California. He knew Pitt better than any man alive, any woman for that matter. Pitt possessed, in a sense, 2 separate inner identities, neither directly related to the other. There was the congenial Dirk Pitt, who rarely deviated from the middle of the road, and was humorous, unpretentious, and radiated an easygoing friendliness with everyone he met. Then there was the other Dirk Pitt, the coldly efficient machine who seldom made a mistake, and who often withdrew into himself, remote and aloof. If there was a key that would unlock the door between the two, Giordino had yet to discover it. Giordino turned his attention back to the depth gauge. Its needle indicated 1,200 feet. Soon they passed the 2,000-foot mark and entered a world of perpetual night. From this point downward, as far as the human eye was concerned, there was only pure blackness. Giordino pushed a switch, and the outside lights burst on and sliced a reassuring path through the darkness. "What do you think our chances are of finding her on the first try?" he asked. "If the computer data Admiral Sandecker sent us hold true, the Titanic should lie somewhere within a 110-degree arc, 1,300 yards southeast of the spot where you reclaimed the Cornet." "Oh, great," Giordino mumbled sarcastically. "That narrows it down from looking for a toenail in the sands of Coney Island to searching for an albino boll weevil in a cotton field." "There he goes again," Gunn said, offering his negative thought for the day. "Maybe if we ignore him," Pitt laughed, "he'll go away." Giordino grimaced and motioned into the watery void. "Oh, sure. Just drop me off at the next corner." "We'll find the old girl," Pitt said resolutely. He pointed at the illuminated clock on the control panel. "Let's see. It's 0640 now. I predict we'll be over the Titanic's decks before lunch, say about 11:40. Giordino gave Pitt a sideways look. "The great soothsayer has spoken." "A little optimism never hurts," Gunn said. He adjusted the exterior camera housings and triggered the strobe. It flashed blindingly for an instant, like a shaft of lightning, reflecting millions of planktonic creatures that hung in the water. 10,000 feet and 40 minutes later, Pitt reported to the MODOC, giving the depth and the water temperature, 35 degrees. The three men watched fascinated as a small anglerfish, ugly in its stubby appearance, slowly swept past the viewports. The tiny, luminous bulb that protruded from the top of its head glowed like a lonely beacon. At 12,375 feet, the seafloor came into view, moving up to meet the sea slug as though she were standing still. Pitt turned on the propulsion motors and adjusted the altitude angle, gently stopping the sea slug's descent and turning her on a level course across the bleak red clay that carpeted the ocean floor. Gradually, the ominous silence was broken by the rhythmic hum that came from the sea slug's electric motors. At first, Pitt had difficulty distinguishing rises and gradual drops on the bottom. There was nothing to indicate a three-dimensional scale. His eyes saw only a flatness that stretched beyond the reach of the lights. There was no life to be seen. And yet, evidence proved otherwise. Scattering tracks from the depth's habitants meandered and zigzagged in every direction through the sediment. One might have guessed that they were made only recently, but the sea can be misleading. The footprints from deep-dwelling sea spiders, sea cucumbers, or starfish might have been made several minutes ago or hundreds of years past. Because the microscopic animal and plant remains that comprise the deep ocean ooze filters down from above at the rate of only 1 or 2 centimeters every 1,000 years. "There's a lovely creature," Giardino said, pointing. Pitt's eye followed Giardino's finger and picked out a strange blue-black animal that seemed to cross between a squid and an octopus. It had 8 tentacles linked together like the web foot of a duck, and it stared back at the sea slug through 2 large globular eyes that formed nearly a third of its body. "A vampire squid," Gunn informed them. "Ask her if she's got relatives in Transylvania," Giardino grinned. "You know," Pitt said, "that thing out there sort of reminds me of your girlfriend." Gunn jumped in. "You mean the one with no boobs?"
"You've seen her?"
"Rave on, envious rabble," Giardino grumbled. "She's mad about me, and her father keeps me floating in quality booze." "Some quality," Pitt snorted. "Old cesspool bourbon, Attila the Hun gin, Tijuana vodka. Who the hell ever heard of those labels?" Throughout the next few hours, the wit and the sarcasm bounced off the walls of the sea slug. Actually, it was put on, a defense mechanism to relieve the gnawing pangs of monotony. Unlike romanticized fiction, wreck hunting in the depths can be a grueling and tedious job. Add to that the aggravated discomfort of the cramped quarters, the high humidity and chilling temperatures inside the submersible, and you have the ingredients for provoking an accident through human error that could prove both costly and fatal. Pitt's hands stayed rock steady as they handled the controls, guiding the sea slug a scant 4 feet above the bottom. Giardino's concentration was nailed to the life support systems, while Gunn kept his eyes skinned on the sonar and magnetometer. The long hours of planning were over. It was now a case of patience and persistence, mixed with that peculiar blend of eternal optimism and love of the unknown shared by all treasure seekers.
"Looks like a pile of rocks up ahead," Pitt said. Giardino stared up through the viewports. "They're just sitting there in the ooze. I wonder where they came from. Perhaps ballast thrown overboard from an old windjammer." "More likely came from icebergs," Gunn said. "Many rocks and bits of debris are carried over the sea and then dropped to the floor when the icebergs melt." Gunn broke off in the middle of his lecture. "Hold on. I'm getting a strong response on the sonar. Now the magnetometer is picking it up, too." "Where away?" Pitt asked. "On a heading of 137. 137 it is," Pitt repeated. He swept the sea slug into a graceful bank as though she was an airplane, and headed on the new course. Giardino peered intently over Gunn's shoulder at the green circles of light on the sonar scope. A small dot of pulsating brightness indicated a solid object, 300 yards beyond their range of vision. "Don't get your hopes up," Gunn said quietly. "The target reads too small for a ship." "What do you make of it?"
"Hard to say. No more than 20 or 25 feet in length, about 2 stories high. Might be anything."
"Or it might be one of the Titanic's boilers," Pitt cut in. "The seafloor should be littered with them." "You move to the head of the class," Gunn said, excitement creeping into his tone. "I have an identical reading, bearing 115. And here comes another, at 160. The last has an indicated length of approximately 70 feet.
"Looks like one of her smokestacks," Pitt said.
"Lord," Gunn murmured hoarsely. "It's beginning to read like a junkyard down here." Suddenly, in the gloom at the outer edge of the blackness, a rounded object became visible, haloed in the eerie light like an immense tombstone. Soon, the three pairs of eyes inside the submersible could distinguish the furnace gratings of the great boiler, and then the row upon row of rivets along the iron seams, and the torn, jagged tentacles of what was left of its steam tubing.
"How would you like to have been a stoker in those days and fed that baby?" Giardino muttered.
"I picked up another one," Gunn said. "No, wait, the pulse is getting stronger. Here comes the length. 100 feet. 2.
"Keep coming, sweetheart," Pitt prayed.
500. 7. 800 feet. "We got her. We've got her."
"What course?"
Pitt's mouth was as dry as sand. "Bearing 097, Gunn replied in a whisper.
They spoke no more for the next few minutes as the sea slug closed the distance. Their faces were pale and strained with anticipation. Pitt's heart was pounding painfully in his chest, and his stomach felt as if it had a great iron weight in it and a huge hand crushing it from the outside. He became aware that he was allowing the submersible to creep too close to the ooze. He pulled back the controls and kept his eyes trained through the viewport. What would they find? A rusty old hulk far beyond hope of salvaging? A shattered, broken hull buried to its superstructure in the muck? And then his straining eyes caught sight of a massive shadow looming up ominously in the darkness.
"Christ Almighty," Giardino mumbled in awe. "We've struck her fair on the bow."
As the range narrowed to 50 feet, Pitt slowed the motors and turned the sea slug on a parallel course with the ill-fated liner's waterline. The mere size of the wreck, when viewed from alongside her steel plates, was a staggering sight. Even after nearly 80 years, the sunken ship proved to be surprisingly free of corrosion. The gold band that encompassed the 882-foot black hull glistened under the high-intensity lights. Pitt eased the submersible upward past the 8-ton portside anchor until they could all clearly make out the 3-foot-high golden letters that still proudly proclaimed her as the Titanic. Spellbound, Pitt picked the microphone from its cradle and pressed the transmit button.
MODOK,
this is Sea Slug. Do you read?" The radio operator on the MODOK answered almost immediately.
"This is MODOK, Sea Slug. We read you. Over."
Pitt adjusted the volume to minimize the background crackle.
"MODOK, notify NUMA headquarters that we have found the Big T. Repeat, we have found the Big T. Depth, 12,340 feet. Time, 1142 hours.
1142? Giardino echoed. "You cocky bastard. You only missed by 2 minutes. Regenesis. The Titanic lay cloaked by the eerie stillness of the black deep and bore the grim scars of her tragedy. The jagged wound from her collision with the iceberg stretched from the starboard forepeak to the number 5 boiler room, nearly 300 feet down her hull, while the gaping holes in her bows below the waterline
betrayed the shattering impact made by her boilers when they tore from her bowels and smashed their way through bulkhead after bulkhead until they plunged free into the sea. She sat heavily in the ooze with a slight list to port, her focussle set on a southerly course, as if she were still pathetically struggling to reach out and touch the waters of a port she had never known. The lights from the submersible danced over her ghost-like superstructure, casting long spectral shadows across her long teak decks. Her portholes, some open, some closed, marched in orderly rows along the broad expanse of her sides. She presented an almost modern, streamlined appearance now that her funnels were gone. The forward three were non-existent, two probably having been carried away by her dive to the bottom, while number four lay fallen across the afterboat deck. And except for the scattered strands of rusty, disconnected funnel rigging that snaked over the railings, her boat deck showed only a few hulking air vents, standing silent guard above the vacant well-endavits that had once held the great liner's lifeboats. There was a morbid beauty about her. The men inside the submersible could almost see her dining saloons and staterooms, flooded with lights and crowded with hundreds of light-hearted and laughing passengers. They could visualize her libraries stacked with books, her smoking rooms filled with the blue haze of gentlemen's cigars, and hear the music of her band playing turn-of-the-century ragtime. The passengers walked her decks, the wealthy, the famous, men in immaculate evening dress, women in colorful ankle-length gowns, nannies with children clutching favorite toys, the Astors, the Guggenheims, and the Strausses in first class, the middle class, the schoolteachers, the clergymen, the students, and the writers in second, the immigrants, the Irish farmers and their families, the carpenters, the bakers, the dressmakers, and the miners from remote villages of Sweden, Russia, and Greece in steerage. Then there were the almost 900 crew members, from the ship's officers to the caterers, the stewards, the lift boys, and the engine room men. Great opulence lay in the darkness beyond the doors and portholes. What would the swimming pool, the squash court, and the Turkish baths look like? Was there a rotten remnant of the great tapestry still hanging in the reception room? What of the bronze clock on the grand staircase, or the crystal chandeliers in the elegant Café Parisien, or the delicately ornate ceiling above the first-class dining saloon? Would perhaps the bones of Captain Edward J. Smith remain somewhere within the shadows of the bridge? What mysteries were there to be discovered within this once colossal floating palace, if and when she ever greeted the sun again? The strobe light on the submersible's camera seemed to flash endlessly as the tiny intruder circled the immense hulk. A large 2-foot rat-tailed fish, with huge eyes and a heavy armored head, skittered over the slanting decks, showing total unconcern for the exploding beams of light. After what seemed like hours, the submersible, the faces of its crew still glued to the viewports, rose over the first-class lounge roof, hovered for a few moments, then deposited a small electronic signal capsule. Its low-frequency impulses would now provide a traceable guideline for future dives to the wreck. Then the submersible made a gliding turn upward. Her lights blinked out, and she melted back into the darkness from whence she had come. Except for the few sparks of marine life that had somehow managed to adapt to survival in the black, bitter-cold environment, the Titanic was alone once more. But soon other submersibles would come, and she would feel the tools of man working on her steel skin again, as she had so many years ago at the great slipways of the Harlan and Wolff shipbuilding firm in Belfast. Then, perhaps, just perhaps, she would make her first port, after all.